Well, good morning, everyone, and Jenny, thank you for leading us so far. People, I'm conscious that when you look around our world, we live in a world that seems to constantly will us to believe that gain is happiness. It's that little phrase, if only. You see it in advertisement on television or the radio or newspapers. They'll not use that phrase, but it's pretty much their message. They'll say, if only you had this product, you'd be happy. Or more accurately, you'd be happier. Or if only you were on this adventure, you would be happier or happier. And it's not just an advertisement. I think there seems to be a common pressure on all of us to always be looking for the latest and the newest. So we go around thinking, well, if only I was in a relationship. Or rather, if only I was in that relationship. Or if only I had a bigger house or a better job. And so we seem to be continuously trying to find something new. Well, today we turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, which is both a very interesting book, but also somewhat unusual. If you compare it to the rest of the Bible, it feels a little bit like when you go into an antique store or a charity shop and finding an object where you're not totally sure what to do with. I mean, opinion is rather divided on Ecclesiastes. Some people wonder, is this a heretic speaking? Or is it a seeker, if you wanted to be a little bit more kind? But people wonder, is this a happy book or a happy message? Or rather, a sad, even a gloomy message? The result is that, although it's probably more familiar in the world, think of maybe a wedding where you've heard phrases like two are better than one, and a cord of three strands is not easily broken. Or some famous pop songs that have used some of the wordings of there being a time for everything. The reality is, and particularly among Christians, is that the book of Ecclesiastes is accepted in theory because, well, it is in the Bible, isn't it? But not necessarily in practice. And yet, this book is incredibly apt for us today. Ecclesiastes actually takes a serious look at life. And I think what it does is it addresses our life expectancy. I'm not just talking about how long we think we may live, but actually what we imagine or expect of life itself, its contents. What are our dreams and our ambitions? And it probably differs whatever age you are. But we're busy with it, aren't we? Although reflecting on life in such a serious way as Ecclesiastes does isn't something that we're always comfortable with, and so most of us tend to just try to keep busy so that we don't have to. But let's be honest. Lockdown has forced us to reflect, as it very much has disrupted normality. And people, I don't want us to miss out on what God may want to teach us at this time. So let's turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. And if you look at chapter 1, verse 1, it says that these are the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, we always really encourage you to read the passage for yourself in preparation for a Sunday. And hopefully you'll read through the whole of Ecclesiastes. But you'll probably find it's not the easiest of books to read. For example, it's not like some of the prophets in the Bible that seem to have a direct message from God to be applied to the people. This book is probably more comparable to musings. Someone is reflecting on what they see in life and write down their thoughts and their conclusions. It's also a book which is harder to maybe place in history because there's very little mention of some of the big names in the Bible, like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and any of the other big events of God working in and for his people. And talking of God, in some ways God feels a little bit in the background, certainly in the opening chapters. And it's not until a little bit later on that there is a clearer picture of actually how this book relates to our relationship with God. And then there's the whole question of the author and this speaker, proclaimed or described in the ESV as the preacher. Many in the past have taken this opening verse simply to refer to King Solomon. I mean, wasn't he the son of David? But there's a lot of question whether that is true or not. A a lot of people think that actually the Hebrew that is used here is of a much later period than King Solomon himself. And even some of the other references, not so much in chapter 1, but later on, don't seem to give us much on the true identity of the author. And actually, maybe that's not a bad thing. Perhaps it's intentional for us not to be totally sure or clear and know exactly who the author is, so that we focus and are forced to focus on the content and hear his message instead. I do believe this first verse gives that sense of authority. It is a royal start. It's not just Joe Bloggs that has put this book together, so we're encouraged to sit up and listen. And I also believe that very much we're meant to be looking ahead and looking forward to the ultimate son of David, the king in Jerusalem, Jesus, the Messiah. And let us remember that if we consider ourselves Christians today, we are in a very privileged position of having a perspective that this author wouldn't have had at that time. And that is that we know that whoever believes in Jesus will enjoy the resurrection life that Jesus promises and that he accomplished through his death. Similarly then, the Kohelet, as the Hebrew says, the preacher, is also a quite ambiguous term. Literally, it refers to someone who participated in an assembly. But again, there's nothing more certain that can be said about him. Some think that actually the relationship between the author and the speaker is one of editor and someone who listened to the arguments, but then tried to correct them at the end. But actually, one wonders if that reasoning could be somewhat motivated by our comfort level, and that sometimes that can lead to making the book more neat and tidy than it truly is, because we like neatness, don't we? The ultimate conclusion is that actually there's no conflict between the author and the speaker. And let's be fair, if it is a book that grapples with reality, should we expect a book that is rather complex, because reality is complex? Those are just a few thoughts as introduction. Hopefully they'll encourage you to really read Ecclesiastes for yourself. But let's ask ourselves then this question. What is it that the speaker has to say about life or life expectancy? What he tells us in verse 2. He says, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Isn't it great that a book starts with a conclusion and you know exactly what is coming afterwards? Interestingly, if you're used to reading the NIV, which is another translation, you'll come across the word meaningless. Everything is meaningless. But most commentators now believe that that is not a very helpful word, particularly with the connotation that it brings in today's language. It probably is an overstating of the sentiment that the author is trying to get across. And actually, when you read throughout the rest of Ecclesiastes, it's not its conclusion about everything. There are actually things that are meaningful. So he'd be wrong in saying at the beginning of his book that everything is meaningless, when later on he actually says not everything is meaningless. So probably a better translation is the more literal meaning of the Hebrew, and that is the word vapor or breath. So a literal translation would be, "The merest of breaths," says Kohelet, "the merest of breaths, everything is a breath." So life, says the author of Ecclesiastes, is the merest of breath. Have you ever been out on one of those icy mornings where you can see your breath? Now, it probably would look silly, but maybe the next time try to catch it, get a hold of your breath, and then put it in your pocket to try to hold on to it for later in the day. You can't, can you? Or if you've ever had a birthday cake and you blow out the candles, there's that waft, there's that smoke still coming even though the flame has been extinguished. It's there. But then all of a sudden, it's gone. Well, that is the picture that Ecclesiastes wants us to get and understand about life. Life is like vapor. It's fleeting, it's short, it's unpredictable, it's ungrabbable, if that is an English word. Whether you live for 25 years or 110 years, life is elusive. A little bit like that song from The Sound of Music, where they sing about how do you solve a problem like Maria, and the phrase comes in, how do you catch a cloud? That's exactly the problem. You can't. You can't control it. Well, the same word in Hebrew, hebel, actually is linked to the name Abel, from Cain and Abel, which probably sums up the meaning again, as someone whose life was cut short, here today, gone tomorrow. And we also find it used in some of the Psalms, like Psalm 39, verse 5. You, O Lord, have made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Each man's life is but a breath. Breath. Or if you were with us through the James series, in James chapter 4, verse 14, the same thoughts came back there as well. What is your life, says James? For you are mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. So what Ecclesiastes will do for us when we listen carefully is it will remind us of the fragile and fleeting nature of existence. And this is true for both Christians and non-Christians alike, because ultimately all of us will one day die. Now, you can't help but think, is this person going through a midlife crisis? Is this person down on his luck? Is he facing some critical illness that he's so down and this is his conclusion on life? Well, actually, no. When you look to verse 12 and 13, we understand that this preacher was king over Israel and Jerusalem. He'd applied his heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And in verse 16 he says, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Actually, he's writing this from a position of wealth, of well-being, being well-educated, and actually his conclusions are well-researched. So how does he come to his conclusions? Well, it's simply by, in this chapter, observing creation. Looking at the sun and seeing it set, but then knowing it will also rise again the next morning. If you're from the west of Scotland or the west of Ireland, you know how beautiful these sunsets are. And if you ever observed one, I'm sure you're not one inch concerned whether that sun will come up again the next morning. Now, I remember going to the Grand Canyon and actually getting up early enough to see the sunrise coming over up over the Grand Canyon and seeing the colors change. It is astonishing. Did I wonder or worry if it was coming up? No, I was just more concerned when and what time I had to get up. These things, he concludes, are perpetual. We don't go to bed worrying about it. And in a similar way, when you look at the wind, you realize that these winds go round and round and round. They don't all of a sudden disappear. They come and they go. Well, what about this picture of the rain? Do you remember seeing these in school? I remember seeing them in school. How the water evaporates, then becomes clouds, hits the mountains, becomes rain, and then comes back through the rivers into the sea. And he's observed this, and he has to conclude that actually, even though this is ongoingly happening, the seas do not fill up. And I think what he wants us to see is not only should we not worry because these things will continue on even after we're gone, actually he wants us to realize that when you and I are gone, we're not going to be remembered as long as we think we might. We'll be quickly surpassed by the next generation. Yet all these things, the sun, the wind, the rain, will continue their service to God's creation. It's a sobering thought in some ways, isn't it? Looking at the big picture rather than just us here and now. So he's saying life is like a breath, short and elusive, circular rather than linear. And it will resist any attempts to capture or to contain it. And when you think about life, it's true, isn't it, that most of us like it neat and tidy. Yes, there's the adventurous people amongst us, but most of us, when it comes to adventure, we like it well planned and manage our risks. Because when life is anything but neat and tidy, when we lose our jobs all of a sudden, or we lose a friend, or perhaps a spouse or a son or daughter, our reaction quite often is, this shouldn't be. Well, let's just pause there for a moment and listen to this testimony of one of our own Bellevuers about the reality of life that is hid in her life. Let's listen to Gillian now.
Gillian asked if I'd be willing to share a bit of my journey recently and how I've seen God's hand at work upon my life. And as you know, it's truly not like me to want to share, but without doubt, God has been very close to me in many situations recently, and I've clearly felt his presence. Just over 2 months ago, I'd been at work, and as the day went on, I started to feel unwell. I'm quite a stubborn person and was determined to make it to the end of my shift and just get home. God's plan was slightly different to mine. I did make it to the end of my shift, but before I left the ward, I felt quite unwell and required the help of the medical staff that I work with. I ended up as a patient on the ward for that night. As much as I didn't want to be a patient on my ward at St. John's, I knew that I wasn't well. But much to my relief, the next day, a bed became available for me at the Western General Hospital, and I was transferred into their care. As the hospital was quieter due to COVID restrictions, the doctors there were able to organise investigations and scans within a few days, and then they confirmed their suspicions that I had bowel cancer. I'd known that I wasn't well, but this news still came as a shock, and I found it particularly difficult to tell family and friends. In the days to follow, I felt a real sense of God's presence. God gave me a comfortable room and care in hospital staff, gave me rest at night, and he gave me peace and assurance that he was in control. God gave me thoughts and words of his promises sent from others at the time when I needed them most. He's given me a lovely surgical and oncology team that are taking great care of me and working through a treatment plan. For each of us, this has been a very unexpected period in our lives for many different reasons. A verse that I read recently, it's Proverbs 19 verse 21. Many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand. The last few months would definitely not have been part of my life's plan, and I know that life is going to change a bit in the future. I am so thankful for the faithful God that we have, and I know that he's in control of the treatment I receive and the months that lie ahead. But I know that I'm not on this journey alone. I am thankful that I'm covered by the prayers of so many people and surrounded by lovely, loving family, friends, neighbours, church family, colleagues. God has given me a much simpler life at present. He's given me time to rest and a break from work. Given me a great opportunity to get to know my neighbours better. I know that God has a purpose for this time in my life and the months that are to come. One particular verse that has been given to me on many occasions recently, which has been a real comfort, is Psalm 91 verse 4. And it says, "He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and rampart." The words of this verse stand true to me today, And I know that whatever the next few months bring, that I'll be given the strength that I need to get through.
Biblical part of Ecclesiastes' wider context is Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3 describes the fall, the moment of the first disobedience against God. It's our failed human attempt to become like God. And people, the truth is that our actions cannot and will never be able to bring the control that we desire. And therefore, says Kohelet the teacher, he says, toiling for gain is a chasing after the wind. Verse 14, he says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, a striving after wind. Let me just put it slightly differently. He says, because life is fleeting, the question which is asked in chapter 1, verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? The answer to that question is actually nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so, people, life is not to be about gain. It's the wrong question to ask of life. Gain is actually a striving after wind. Try to catch it, try to get hold of it, and it will be gone before you know it. Now, the word gain, the Hebrew word here, is more the sense of surplus. So it's not that we're not allowed to work for our food and for our basic needs, but it's surplus. It's actually the things we don't necessarily need, but that we're always out to get the more in life. And it's true, isn't it? That we're always looking for new, for more. And I think the reason for this focus on gain in our life is, I think, a natural self-centeredness. Also, the natural pride that comes in us. We want to gain so that we can show off to other people and so that we're more comfortable than others. But it probably also comes from this strange conviction that the universe is ultimately comprehensible and therefore malleable, and it can be fashioned to our own needs. But people, the futility of gain is all around us. You know, if you had all the stuff in the world, you still have to do your dishes, don't you? Now, you might get somebody else to do it. You might have a dishwasher, but you still have to load the dishwasher and unload the dishwasher. And with dishes, as soon as you've done them, you turn your back and come back 5 minutes later, there's new dishes sitting in the sink or dusting. Nobody gets away from having to dust their house. And what a wearisome task. Now, I don't want to give the impression that I'm always doing it. We try to do it together in our house. But as soon as you've done it, you feel you have to go back and do it all again. And it's not just that. It's not just the small things in life. It's the big things in life, too. Think of any management restructuring. If you've been in a business long enough, you'll have seen one or two come by. And sometimes they seem to do the exact same thing as they tried a few years ago. Or perhaps it's the food fads. Or perhaps it's stocks and your pension that you're trying to secure for later life. Even your job itself or relationships. All of these seem to be coming and going. Is there really anything in life that seems to truly last and is secure? Well, I think Kohelet wants to warn us. He wants to remind us that actually ultimately there's no gain in the end for any of us. Is this depressing? Actually, no, it isn't, because we're not meant to live for gain. Jesus himself said in Mark chapter 8, verse 36, he says, what does it actually profit a man if he gained the whole world and yet forfeited his soul? What this teacher is trying to do is he's trying to deconstruct all the ways that we find meaning and purpose apart from God. You know, do we want to own the whole world? Well, maybe not the whole world, but part of it. Do we want to win it? Do we want to master it? Or do we actually want to gain the wisdom that is found in this book to admit that actually life is a mystery, life is a vapor, and actually in many ways we should learn to relax more, to breathe it in, and to take a hold of the grace that is found in it. There's something very freeing to think, actually, do you know what? There's no need for the chase. There's sufficient reward in life itself if it is received as a gift from God and lived well. People, the sun will rise again and again and again. It's how God has created it. Plus, remember, the best is yet to come when Christ returns. Now, of course, people, this is not an excuse for laziness, but people, it is neither an excuse for us to make profit the ultimate thing, for the thing that will really give us that fulfillment and that joy. And yet that is so often what we live for our achievements. Have you ever played the game of life? I haven't played it in a long time, but I remember you get a little car. There's no dice, you spin the wheel. And basically what you do is you pick up education and family, kids, then a job, and then a better job, and you work through a career and houses, and all of it is grown. And of course, at the end of the game is the one with the most money or stuff wins, right? See, that's what we get taught. But people, in a recent television program on life in Monaco, you can't help but just be questioning the same questions, asking the same questions as we find in Ecclesiastes. Is that the dream we live for? To live for luxury and be able to buy a big boat? People, actually, in another 10 or 20 years' time, who or what of all of that will actually be left? Life is the merest breaths. So how then should we respond? What do we do with it? A recent article in a travel magazine caught my eye with an interesting title saying, "Embrace the Dark Side." Now, it had nothing to do with Star Wars or Star Trek or any of that. Basically, the author was a hiker, and he explained that he'd been on a recent hike up to these new established dark sky reserves. Dark sky reserves. This one was in Snowdonia, and he found that it ended up endlessly illuminating. Here was his conclusion. For basically, what he found was that actually only by being in one of these dark sky reserves, he had finally managed to see the wonder of the stars and the galaxies, because here was no light pollution. It made me think of our pandemic and lockdown, which hasn't been easy. But I wonder if God is asking us to embrace the dark side. And for this pandemic, perhaps to be our reserve, our dark night reserve. The place where we're actually, although it's not easy, is the place where we can see more clearly what God has intended for us and for this life. And then when we're there, to allow Ecclesiastes and Qohelet, almost like a friend who sits us down and calls a halt to all the various attempts on our behalf to make something of our lives. And for us to listen to him as he tries to make us understand and keep us and warn us from being deluded and placing all our hopes on illusions. Somebody called the book of Ecclesiastes smelling salts. Well, have you ever smelled smelling salts? They're nasty. They're uncomfortable, but they do their job. So that's one thing. May this serve as a warning to us. But of course, secondly, let us also take on the challenge that I think Ecclesiastes leaves with us. And that is, do we dare to face reality in the way that the author of Ecclesiastes dared to face reality for what a tree is? To wrestle with it, but ultimately to acknowledge that actually we've been devoted to illusions, and then to be willing to relinquish the control we so eagerly look for. Because when we dare to do that, what will follow is an invitation. And the invitation you'll find in this book is the invitation to turn to God. Ecclesiastes' message, I think, is very much there to humble us, to lead us to repentance and for us to be driven towards God. As Ian Proven, one of the best commentaries I've read on Ecclesiastes, puts it, he says, the main obstacle to living well is that mortal beings consistently refuse to accept mortality and finitude, wanting to live our lives by ourselves and on our own terms, often with an arrogant, even an ignorant expectation of life. People, may we, through this book, start to acknowledge our limitations, but by doing so, then look to the one without limitations, the Almighty, the All-Loving, the All-Knowing, God Creator, and for us to give Him our full attention. And to put the energy that we're putting into all the gain we're trying to achieve, placing it in that one goal, knowing God and loving Him wholeheartedly. People, the quest is for us to learn to embrace life for what it is, rather than what we always would like it to be. For us to stop chasing after wind, to give up our relentless, wearisome quest for gain, but instead to learn contentment in the simplicity of life. And instead, to learn to look to the ultimate Son of David, our true wisdom, who has gained for us that which is lasting. Do you know how He did it? By being willing to lose everything, leaving the riches of heaven and making Himself nothing in order for us to receive that everlasting life. Life in all its fullness. Peace with God. Forgiveness of sin. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, in a strange way, we actually want to thank You for these recent months. They haven't been easy, but we acknowledge that perhaps this lockdown is there to stop us in our tracks and to reveal something of life we normally choose to ignore. We very much pray that Your warning will enable us to find true life, not the illusion that we hold on to, the hope that we have, if only. So Lord, this morning we want to pause and actually acknowledge our limitations. We repent of our attempts to control and even of our quest for gain, which is actually a chasing after wind. And instead we turn to the Maker of the wind, the one who holds all things in His hands and will one day make all things new. Lord, we thank You for the gift of life. We want to live it in gratitude for You and for You alone, for Your glory.